Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling like a rebel.
Really?
Yes.
In what way?
With a cause, because I love today's guest. I think he is someone that inspires me to speak out more than I usually would, because sometimes it can be scary to criticize people, especially in the art world, or call them out.
You quite like doing it, though. Yeah, you like quite like
yeah, between
people.
Me and you,
criticize
I do,
me.
But yeah. I love criticizing you, Russ.
But
what I love about today's guest is that he is someone that calls out kind of bad behavior and people who are doing kind of crappy things in the art world, actually. And he writes an amazing column for ArtNet, which has been going on for a long time, and he's also just incredibly entertaining. He has this kind of, well, he's been called a provocateur before, and that is quite a good description of him. And I had a very funny experience once years ago when we had the gallery in Shoreditch. We were at the Rivington restaurant, and I think I was talking about the work of our friend Tracy Emin, because we used to have our prints up, and he actually was at another table and overheard the conversation and interrupted me and was like, excuse me, you have really good taste or something. And we had this whole hilarious, very intense conversation across the tables about contemporary art. It was genius. So that just gives you an idea of what he's like. He's very, and also, he loves to
also
interact.
Also, our guest is an artist himself. He's an art collector. He's an art dealer. He's an art writer. He's a curator. He's a teacher, and he's a self-proclaimed hoarder, and he used to be based in London, then he's gone back to the States, then now I think he's somewhere else in Europe. So we're quite interested to talk to our guest today to find out where in the world he actually is now. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art,
Kenny Schachter.
You're putting so much pressure on me. Hi, everybody.
Good.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all right. You've got to be everything now,
Kenny. This is a Talk Art interrogation.
Everything for the whole art world right now.
I have to say, I'm such a fan, and I think what you've done is emblematic of a lot of different things that are going on in the art world that I think are very important, and I'd love to touch upon them. Well, number one, you put a lot of pressure on me to be entertaining, which is going to be tricky in the first of all places. But I mean, I just think the audience that you've developed from your podcast has been extraordinary, and it's really reflective of the overall expansion of the art market, which has grown, not the art market, the art world, which has grown more in the past 25 years than in the previous 250 years. So I think it's quite an amazing phenomenon that you guys are spearheading in part of yourselves.
Oh, thanks, Kenny. That's amazing. Well, it's what an endorsement to come from you, like art world royalty, art world... magic,
asshole.
You know, you've art world asshole. Yeah. So where in the world are you right now?
Well, I'm in Spain with the family right now, in the south of Spain.
Have you been there since lockdown? Or
since they never listened to me, I always love a captive audience like you guys that I can speak to. I was in New York for 3 months during the quarantine, and I have to say, like, I mean, I'm a professor at the School of Visual Arts, and I had a Zoom class for 2 months into the quarantine, and I was in New York City, and you would imagine from reading the press that people were just keeling over in the street from illness, which of course we suffered one of the greatest tragedies in the world, and certainly in my lifetime, and I'm quite old, and I'm sure in most people, and it's been a terrible thing, but it's certainly in New York City or in America wasn't as bad as the press would make it out to be. There's a lot of fear mongering going on a lot of different fronts. And also in the art world, I have to say, for other reasons. But I mean, I was working, I was teaching, I was able to get out and walk every day. Central Park was filled with people, albeit there was a hospital in Central Park, which I don't, a tent hospital, which I don't think ever really thankfully had much activity going on. But then I went to Europe because my kids were back in London. I went to see them and spent a little bit of time in London, and now I've been in Spain.
Oh, that's good. And talking about the art market then, during this whole pandemic, there was fear that it was going to just cancel itself out and no one would buy work and everything would be a problem. But it felt like the art market has actually gone up another gear. It feels like, especially what's going on in the auctions at the moment and the way that people are collecting, it feels like there isn't a fear of this bubble bursting anytime soon.
Well, the first point, this is, you've touched upon a lot of issues in that one sentence. And the most important issue is that there's not a, I could say emphatically, I don't want to scream and annoy your readers, your listeners more than I'm about to, but there's no bubble. There's never been a bubble, and that's complete absurdity to even, I mean, I'm not saying you, I'm not ready to get into a fight with you just yet, but there is no bubble. And there's two very important key factors about art and humanity. Number one, in terms of the market and collecting, I'm so tired of, like, all the time in the press, whenever there's, like, during 2008, and all the talk was that the art world would be, like you said, canceled, that would utterly evaporate. There's always going to be constrictions in a market in the same vein that all markets go up and down. But since art came off the wall of a cave, it's been coveted. Collecting is part of human nature. When I organized an auction at Sotheby's called The Hoarder, you mentioned hoarding. I collect art. I mean, it's funny because I could tell you one thing. In 100 years from now, when phones are embedded in our forearm, we're going to be talking into our arm saying, hello, hello, can you hear me? Hello.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there'll be technology glitches. The art world will be with us forever, and so will technology problems when we're trying to communicate with each other. Yes. But since art came off the wall of the cave, it's been coveted by people. That's one thing. So art collecting is part of human nature. To live with art has already been medically proven to, like, they've done studies in the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, which is actually accredited as an art, as a museum. Mm-hmm. That they have a very proactive commissioning program in all of the rooms and public spaces. And there's a Veronese old master in the chapel at the hospital. But most importantly, they've done clinical studies that reveal that the patients being surrounded by art has resulted in shorter hospital stays and less medications required of the patients. Art has an actual physiological ameliorative effect on your lives. And I have to say, like, I'm going to get sidetracked a million times, but during the lockdown, it was the first time, like, in 30 years of my career that I wasn't at an airport every 2 weeks. Literally, it was the longest in 25, 30 years that I had not been to an airport traveling. And I was able to rub my nose against a painting or a drawing every single day. Mm. And it just, I mean, to take stock and we're always in a rush and we're always late, but we're never going anywhere really on this treadmill, going to art fairs and going to auctions and running, running, running. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you just have to look what's in front of your nose and you see the world. And so anyway, back to this, I'm going to try to stay on track as much as I can, but living, collecting is as primal as breathing. And it's part of human nature since trading, before money was even invented. And the craziest thing is that, I mean, there's actually studies that currency was created for a Chinese emperor to help him facilitate and continue and expand on his collecting practices.
No way.
Wow. He was such a big art collector. He had like 7,000 objects, and he was also an artist. So the other thing is that art making is the same as taking a crap. I mean, it's part of living, and it's like breathing, eating, sustenance. So people will always make art because it's a reaction. It's a means of communication above all else. And the creative act is so ingrained in the human psyche that it's part of what differentiates us as a species from animals, say. Mm-hmm. So people will always make art and people will always appreciate it. And whether we have to trade shells or anything else or food, during the pandemic, I traded some books I had written for some paper towels when the pandemic first started, because there was a shortage of toilet paper and paper towels. Yeah. So I found someone through Instagram to trade me three rolls of paper towels for four books.
Wow, that's good.
That is like wartime. That's
the dealer side of you. That's like negotiating power. I like that.
Yeah, but I mean, I have to say, I always say I'm the worst art dealer that ever sold a piece of art. I can't sell crack to a crackhead. That's the least interesting. That's the least interesting part of my career. Is I hate. Yeah. I love to buy art, but I hate to sell it.
Okay,
I'm not a salesman.
You you were talking about having your nose up to artworks every day. And when I mentioned that we were interviewing you to an artist that I know yesterday, she said to me, I've always loved him because we sat next to each other at a dinner and he spoke so eloquently about Paul Tech. And that artist is someone that everybody mentions. If you mention Kenny Schachter, Paul Tech.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about how you came to collect his work and discover him? Because I feel like you were one of the first people I ever heard about his work through.
Well, I'm so happy that you asked me that because I was ready for all the worst, most insidious kind of questions. And when you said you brought my name up to someone, half the time you'll get a reaction that's much different from niceties
that's
and talking
like
about
you,
an artist.
Though.
But I mean, see, but that's also really, I mean, people assume, many people in the, I mean, people love me or hate me. There's usually little middle ground. But I mean, first and foremost, I am a lover, an intense psychopathic lover of art, and I'm so wildly passionate about art, and really everything else is a kind of like offshoot that originates and stems from what art does to me, whether it's making it, writing about it, teaching it, looking at it, talking about it. Like all of these things you mentioned are like conversations based that are underpinned by speaking about art. And, you know, I just, sometimes I even hate what I do in terms of my writing, because the art market is something I analyze and I feel compelled to write about it in a forthright and honest way because nobody else speaks the truth in the art world. In fact, the art world is probably the only profession where people embrace lies willfully more than they do the truth. I mean, the art world welcomes fake news in that regard. Mm-hmm. But back to Paul Tech, it touches on a lot of different bases for me and things that are so come to the core of my existence in so many ways. In the first way, not to bring up personal stories so much or news, but like I lost my mother when I was 13 years old to a degenerative disease. And to see someone deteriorate before your eyes when you're a child is one of the most, I mean, from then on, my everything was couched in my experience based on having seen someone that was so dear and I loved so much to pass away through this disease of cancer. Right. And, when I first saw the meat pieces of Paul Tech, so he made these sculptures in the 60s, and they were created with wax, pigment, pieces of plastic, and they emulated the cross-section of flesh. And then he housed them in these very minimalistic vitrines made of plexiglass in yellow often, but they were sort of imprisoned in this box and frozen. And number one, it expresses the vulnerability. When you're young and you're racing around, going to parties and staying out, and you often forget, you think you're invincible and you forget about the vulnerability of life. And what you often look for, you're always looking outside of yourself and you never really think about your organs, what lies within. And that's your heart, your lungs, your kidneys and liver. Right. And when you look at this, and in a way, like I've never seen a depiction in art that so finely represents this kind of hair. It's like the width of a hair that separates between life and death. So in a way, the work is very alive because it's an artwork that you see. It's a physical presence that's so riveting. And I also love the fact that it's like this great, another fine line between repulsion and seduction, because for me, they're some of the most exquisitely beautiful, aesthetically pleasing objects I've ever seen. Number two, like it comes the closest from anything I have ever seen as an artistic representation of life and death simultaneously coexisting. And it also, it's a handmade object which looks so stunningly realistic. And it's also encased in this glass vitrine, which is a very cold object. And in a way, he's also doing a very subtle critique of pop art, which is consumerism and ready-made objects, right, and minimalism, which is machine-rendered, taking the humanity out of art, like Donald Judd just making a metal box, having it fabricated by a machinist. So I was so touched by the work of Paul Tech. It was like, it was even more than an epiphany. It just touched me. I mean, it's made me cry standing in front of the work before. And once I saw that work, I started to, I mean, what I love about art is that art is a lifetime accrual of gaining knowledge and information. And people forget about it so much. Today, even though the market's expanded and the audience has expanded so much, everyone thinks about art, and we're going to touch upon this shortly, but like everyone thinks that art is this immediate situation, the newest, hottest artist going for this kind of money and that kind of money, and what's the newest? Who's the latest undiscovered artist? But art is a slow-burning process that takes a lifetime to gain insight and information about. And that's really what I love more than anything, is just it has this kind of the best part of school and academics is that every day more art is being made and every day there's something else to learn about. And the more I learned about Paul Tech, the more I just fell head over heels in love with the artist and his practice. And also it reflects a lot of very important components about some of these ancillary issues we're talking about the market, because Paul Tech in 1964 had a show in New York at Pace Gallery. By the way, you started me, so if I talk for 3 hours, it's your
Please
fault because you
just go for it.
You
we
kicked
love it.
It. You kicked
this
it
is,
off.
This is the best. And also, we feel very similar to you. Like the whole thing you're saying about constant knowledge, you know, accrual or whatever the word is. Like we feel exactly the same, and that's the reason Russell and I became friends. So I mean, yeah, we totally get it.
I mean, I really like, I don't go, I mean, I'm going to sound like a complete moron, but I lived in London for, I lived in London for 15 years and I saw one theater performance. I don't go to theater. I don't go to movies.
Shocking.
I don't read novels. I read books. I'm not like Posh or anything, Spice, but everything I do is there's so much for me to learn. I teach, so I learn. I write, so I look at things harder and think about things harder. There's so much for me to learn, and I know only a fragment of the art world. The
yes,
art
but
world
what it is
about-
Kenny, what it, I'm going to jump in now. What it is about you, though, is that you've made it a kind of mission of your life to analyze the art world, and you are a dealer, but you are fundamentally a collector and a lover of art. But it is this analytical eye that you have, and you're talking about your writing. We just need to let the listeners know that you have an opinion column for ArtNet News, which is a regular column that you write, which is about the art market, which is telling the truths of it and reveals and the honesty of it all, which a lot of people really admire you for and appreciate. Mm. But what is it about the analytical side of really trying to get into the nuts and bolts of the way that the commercial art market operates that kind of gets it, is like the bee is in your bonnet for that, for how to kind of break down the hierarchies and to reveal the honesties
and agitate
and fundamentally the corruption that is involved in all of that, and where is the future of the art market now during the current climate going forwards.
Are you serious? That was about 47 questions. How
go
much time
us.
Do you have?
We have forever. We can go on.
Okay. No, I was just saying, what is it? What is it about then?
No. I know. Why? I got you. Okay. So let me just finish with Paul Tech. Paul Tech showed at Pace in 1964 and became an art star. He was a good, gorgeous guy. He died of AIDS in 1988 when AIDS was like killed David Wanarovich. And I met Keith Haring when he had Carpazzi sarcoma from AIDS and spoke to him. He was one of the first people to just say, I have AIDS. When AIDS, you were like a pariah. I mean, you guys are too young. But when AIDS first came out in New York City, the art, 25% of the art world just disappeared. And not only that, but like people, there was suspicion that you can get it from, that it was so contagious, you can get it from kissing somebody. And when people, David Wanarovich wrote this incredible article that touched me so much, that one of his friends was thrown out of a restaurant in the East Village, a very famous Polish restaurant, by the proprietor because he had visible signs of the illness. And I mean, that's why all of this activist art sprang up in the 80s. And anyway, Paul Tech died destitute. He went to Italy. He lived in Europe. And the impact of Instagram, and people like, you know, criticize Instagram, blah, blah. But Paul Tech lived in Europe and America completely lost sight of his work and the artist himself. And when he moved back, he was working in a supermarket after he had been in like five of the biggest biennials in the world and died penniless, really, living in a little hovel in the East Village. So the fact is that people, back to the money thing, people don't realize that the market is not a quantifier of quality. That's a super important fact, that like you know, the art market for contemporary art is by definition fashion and temporary. Like we said before, art takes time, and history by definition is something that resolves itself over the course of time. And for artists to be canonized, you can't say an artist who's 30 years old or 40 or 50 even could be worth $15 million because that's absurd. Mm-hmm. Art takes time, and so does a market to define itself. But anyway, Paul, what I say also is that sometimes to be too good or to be too far ahead of the time is even worse than being behind the time, because the art market works like a collective herd of sheep. And oftentimes what drives the markets are not inherent quality of a piece of art. So back to my criticism fact, I mean, I never set out to be this zealot, this messianic lunatic who I've had death threats from my writing. I've had someone try to threaten to beat me up, a 75-year-old lawyer in the middle of a restaurant on Madison Avenue. His name might be Richard Gala, but I'm not going to mention anything.
Well, what was that about, though? Why? What had you written? What was he upset about?
Because I wrote about the last time he tried to beat me up in the middle of a Basel art fair. But I'll get to
that. What was that really, for then? Why did he want to beat you up then?
Because we were friendly, and it's a very stupid thing. I introduced him to an art dealer friend of mine, and he had introduced me to a couple of friends. I even recommended a book agent for him, which he seemed to forget where he got his novel published. And he's made a couple of really garish music videos that you should most definitely look for on YouTube. His name is Richard Golub. But anyway, we actually own three pieces together to this day. And when he made a connection with my friend, I thought that he was going to buy a piece of Asian art, and that's why I made the introduction. And then my friend told me that they actually did a co-investment deal together. This is another issue which we could touch upon how art has changed. But Saatchi's been doing this since the 70s, where people partner up and buy art to sell it. So when I found out from my friend that Richard Golub didn't just buy a painting to hang in his house, but he bought art as an investment, I simply asked my friend for a small percentage of his side of the transaction, which is very typical in the course of business as an art dealer to get such an introductory fee. In fact,
a finder's fee or something.
Yes. If you bring a client to Sotheby's or Christie's or Phillips, if you introduce them to someone who wants to sell a Picasso, you are entitled to an finder's fee. Anyway, right. So I did that, which is all normal. And then the art dealer did something that's very typical in the art world. He tried to shitster and set my friend against me by telling him that I actually had the gall to ask for a commission from the introduction. And Richard Golub went crazy because he had introduced me to people like Simon Lee, the art dealer in London, who I've done, is become a close friend, and we've done business. Anyway, he got very incensed about that. But let me just state that this lawyer is world famous for being, you think I'm an agitator, he's gotten into more fights than Muhammad Ali. He is worldwide famous for being one of the most intransigent, argumentative, aggressive human beings and a bully on the planet Earth. Anyway, so I was in Basel one year in Miami, and in the booth was some DJ, and then Richard Golub started screaming at me in the top of his lungs, even back then, and that was in 2015. And of course, I'm a writer, so that's all fodder for my writing. So I wrote about this encounter I just said, like, perhaps you should look into some anger management, which just seemed to set him off a little more. And I wrote about it. And then from then, every time he saw me subsequent to that, he would threaten me, including last November. And I developed this platform in my writing where I create short narrative videos that never last for more than, say, a minute. And they're narratives, but they're framed for the short Instagram attention spans that as a humans we're like evolving into. Anyway, so like every time he engaged with me, like I would just make art about it or write about it, to the point where the last time I saw him, he finally caught on after like 5 years, where he was just mumbling under his breath. But like all joking aside, I've had death threats, other people throwing fists at me and starting fights. I just last week had two lawsuits threatened against me, and nothing, you know, I was just saying to the lawyer at ArtNet, I was on the phone for an hour last night with the lawyer, and I said, look, nothing's going to stop me. I mean, I almost felt like stopping writing these kinds of columns altogether from the anxiety and the stress.
It must worry you, yeah, the anxiety from it. Is it worth it, the anxiety?
You know what? I don't care if I get shot doing what I'm doing. I just don't care. It worries me and it bothers me, of course, but I just said to Artnet, I'm like, you know what? I'll sign an agreement where I personally assume the liability for this threat of a lawsuit or any other one. Because I said to my kids 2 days ago that I just can't deal with it anymore. I need to take a hiatus. It's just too much. There's no upside. I get paid so little for my writing, but I do it because, and then, like I said, I said to the lawyer and I said to this agitating person who instigated a lawsuit, and I said, nothing is going to throttle me. I'm not even going to let myself throttle me. And the reason I do it is because the art world is veiled. It's like the mafia omerta. It's a code of secrecy where nobody talks about the machinations of the... I never set out to be this kind of person. I mean, I've been writing for 30 years. I used to write for the first 15 years or 20 years of my writing. I wouldn't have even called myself a writer for one very good reason. Nobody read me. Nobody read anything I wrote because the iPhone only began in 2007 and Instagram, which I think is by far the most revolutionary art platform in the history of art up to this stage, where it is a democratic wrecking ball, which is deeply affecting the ingrained, entrenched hierarchies that are so prevalent in the art world. But as a result of the writing, when I started writing, I took a break after a while because Artnet closed their magazine and they literally closed it and went out of business for a few years and then they relaunched it. But when I started to write again in around 2000 and let's say 12, 13, 14, I would write something and it was really what I had always done, except this time my work was much more accessible and the audience for art has mushroomed, like we've said before, and grown so substantially. And I remember in particular, I was mistreated by some person who calls themselves a collector. And like nowadays, if you ever found a collector that has never resold a piece of art, they belong in a vitrine in the Natural History Museum. I mean, they're so few and far between. And basically, it's like, I'm like I said before, I could be both of your dads. I'm old. I've been through a lot of shit. I've been through some awful family tragedies in the past couple of years. I've been through a lot. I've been in the art world for 30 years. I've been collecting art for 30 years. I don't rely on anyone for my sustenance or anything other than my own activities and actions. And I have nothing to lose. I mean, I have my life to lose, but I have nothing to lose. I don't feel beholden to anyone in the art world. And I started writing these columns again, like phase two of my writing career. And it started to resonate with people. And I just remember I wrote about this one Belgian collector and who really mistreated me and another collector badly. And I remember going to FIAC, the art fair in Paris, and walking down the aisle and just people kept coming up to me and thanking me. And I thought it was like the craziest thing because I was really touching a nerve with people where they were grateful and showing their appreciation for the fact of my honesty and forthrightness.
An expose, and, yes.
Yeah, but I mean like, the fact is that I was saying before, the art world operates on a code of secrecy. Nobody talks about the percentages in deals. Nobody talks about what really drives the behind the scenes activities in the market of buying and selling art. And like I'm a lawyer by training. I studied philosophy. I've been in the fashion business. You would never know it by looking at the way I present myself, which is very scraggly with my pants dragging on the floor, picking up dirt in my old track pants. But the fact is that, again, like back to the exclusivities of the art world, I mean, you walk into a gallery and they look you up and down and make all of these determinations about you and judgments. It's so, the art world has its own brand.
It doesn't feel like that now. But it doesn't feel like that now, though. I feel like we're in a generation now.
I disagree.
Now.
I disagree.
Really?
It doesn't feel like that. You guys are famous, I'm sorry, but if you're a run-of-the-mill Joe that walks into a gallery and tries to buy something, they're going to give you the third degree. And if you look like me, they're not even going to barely want to open the door and let you in. They make all of these assumptions.
Also, I feel like the galleries that we go to aren't necessarily the galleries we go to are often so tiny, Russ. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're supporting a lot of very young, emerging artists.
Some of these galleries, once an artist is coveted, no matter if they're 20 years old or 120, whether the gallery is one person working for it or 10, it gives a balance of power to the dealer, and the whole power of art dealers is in access. And the art world still operates on a very hierarchical foundation, and it's rife with hypocrisy. The art world has its own brand of hypocrisy. And I don't care how small or big the gallery is, if they have an artist that everybody wants, they are going to behave in a way where it's like you can't help yourself. They have a so-called waiting list, but a waiting list is a misnomer. A waiting list means whoever's more important than you, which could for me is everybody, that means they're all going to be ahead of me on the list because that's the way the art world works. I'm sorry. So I'm just saying that.
I was going to say, who in the hierarchy of the art world then, who for you is at the top of the pyramid and who's at the bottom of the pyramid?
I mean, there's two veins to the answer of that question. I mean, you guys don't even get a chance to get a question in with me. All you do is wind me up and I go on automatic pilot. That's great. You can just shut your microphones off and I'll just finish by myself. But the fact is so in the commercial art world, Roberta Smith is a writer for the New York Times. She also is married to Jerry Saltz, but let's talk about Roberta. When I curated my very first show in 1990, before you guys were probably alive, Roberta walked into my
life.
So I used to do these, we called them hit and run shows because that was even before the word pop-up existed. And I would take over an empty space, trade a few paintings that I had managed to collect when I was a part-time lawyer. And I would take over space and stage an exhibition. I showed Cecily Brown in the 90s, Wade Guyton, a lot of artists that have gone on to great acclaim, Rachel Harrison.
Joe Bradley was one of yours, wasn't he?
Joe Bradley gave him his first show. Catherine Bernhardt, her first show. All in these kind of guerrilla pop-up spaces. And somehow, I don't even know how, but I clocked Roberta Smith. And this was the very first show I ever curated. And I walked up to her and I said, this is a painting by an artist, Walter Stedding, and this is about. And as soon as I said the word about, she turned on her heels and looked at me and said, if I needed anyone to explain the art to me in a gallery, I would never leave my house and go to a gallery again. And then she looked at the show and walked out, and a single tear welled up in the corner of my eye and started trickling down my cheek, like from this famous TV commercial in America about pollution. And there's an Indian standing in the street and some asshole throws like a bag of garbage at his feet and a tear drops on his face. And that was me. And then like literally 20 years later, Roberta wrote me a letter. I got to the point where whenever I saw her, I would be cowering under my desk, hiding from her. And at one point, Jerry said, Roberta wants to speak to you. And I was so petrified. And I went up to her and she wanted to know about a mini car that I had when I imported one of the first minis into the US. But then 20 years later, she wrote me an article and saying how much she really liked and appreciated my writing for these very reasons we're talking about. And I just broke down in hysterics, crying again for the opposite reason. It made me so happy.
That's an endorsement, isn't it? Yeah, that's someone you really respect.
And she continues to be one of my most supportive readers, and then I know I'm doing something right. So back to your question, which miraculously I've managed to remember, but there are two tiers to the art world. There's the bullshit commercial sector, which I critique, and then there's the art-loving Paul Tech, Vito Acconci world of just pure passion, which is really what drives me. So Roberta Smith used to be the most powerful person on the planet Earth, in the planet art Earth. And I remember a dealer running up to me, waving a newspaper in her hand. And I said, what happened? What happened? And she said, my artist just got a review by Roberta Smith. And it was one of the nastiest critical reviews I've ever seen. But she was so happy just to be reviewed by Roberta, even when it was a negative review. So critics used to be omnipotent. Critics and museums used to be at the head of the fray. They used to be at the top of the pyramid. Then the art market and the money side literally took over, not just like the speculating side of things, but it went much deeper than that. And then there's another issue that sets me off, which I'm sure is going to make a whole other lot of people hate me for all new reasons. But I generally despise private museums. The only private museums that should exist are not in Los Angeles, not in New York, not in London, but in China or in the middle of America or in the middle of England, where there's not ready access to art galleries and museums. So when you have a gallery, a museum in Los Angeles, I'm going to say this and I'm probably going to get sued again, but like I should keep a lawyer on staff. But there's a museum by, there was a Marciano Museum owned by the people, the owners of Guess Jeans. So like they're presenting themselves as a quote unquote museum. In America, you get, it's replete with tax breaks. So they're saving money on storing and insuring their collection, all kinds of tax breaks they receive. And at the same time, it's curatorship minus something very important called scholarship. And I'm really, to be honest, I'm not that interested in the collection of someone who began collecting art 10 years ago and seems to like, again, I'm not picking on this family in any sense. I know it sounds like that, but ignore me. But what I'm trying to say is that like, when you have a private museum in the middle of a domain where there's a lot of public institutions, the art world operates on a zero-sum game, which means that a lot of people that will go to visit a private museum in the smack in the middle of Los Angeles will do so at the expense of the two gigantic, long established museums, LACMA and MoCA, the Museums of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles, even the Broad Museum, which has a great collection, but it's really like a night sale auction derived collection. And the fact that really annoys me is that those museums are sucking away an audience that would, if there were no these fake museums existing in the middle of town, the audience would go to where they should be going, which is the public institutions. And also a lot of that art that ends up in the private museums like the Broad, he was the head of the museum of one of the LA's museums, and the art in his museum would have for shit sure ended up in the collection of the public institutions that have painstakingly built up their constituencies over decades. So anyway, it used to be that critics and museums like the Metropolitan Museum and the Museum of Modern Art and the Tate were the all-powerful at the very top of the mountain when it comes to legitimizing art. And and then when the market took over and like really there's a vein of art which you could probably use as the poster child for this type of art, the Diamond Skull by Damien Hirst, where the money is not, it's not just about the money, it is the money. The diamonds and the value of the diamonds he affixed to his skull, 8,000 of them, worth God knows how many millions. You'll never get the truth from anyone involved in the transaction, not even what ultimately happened to it and the consortium that ended up buying it, but we won't get into that. I hope you guys have a good insurance policy. But anyway, it's like instead of pop art or abstract expressionism, it's economicsism today. So oftentimes the art is just the discourse. I mean, this is another really important thing. When I teach so I could learn. And I usually teach seminars on art and economics and, you know, this kind of market conversation we're having. But I started teaching at the School of Visual Art, fine art students. And that was as scary for me as being having my life threatened, because I never took an art class in my entire life. I'm completely self-taught. And I said to my students the first day, I feel so lucky to be able to sit in front of you because I never get to talk about art because I'm in the art world and nobody wants to hear about art. They just want to hear, where is the artist showing? Who's buying it? Who's selling it? So the whole discourse on art has almost become dissected or divorced from the art itself. So back to the powers that be, the top of the pile today are collectors. I was going to curate a show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and they had no money to paint the walls between exhibitions because they're being robbed of the financial resources, tragically, by the private sector. So today the collectors have all the power. The galleries that have artists that everybody wants to buy gives them this disproportionate power of access. So a lot of art dealers will say, you could buy the artist you want. If you buy three artists you don't want from my gallery, then I'll consider you. I mean, this is bullshit. I mean, and also like imagine going to a fashion designer and saying, and you go into a boutique and they say, you know what? We're not going to sell you this dress because we just don't think you're the kind of person we want to project the image of our brand. And that's basically what art galleries do when they would, this fake waiting list, and they would rather sell to someone who has a private museum because that'll give the art some more prestige and some more PR and, yeah, some more visibility, more than you can as a mere lover of art that simply wants to adorn your wall with the painting. So really, the hierarchy is, I mean, it goes like collector first, then I would say artist because of, I mean...
Okay, good. I was going to wait for you to say the art. Where does the artist stand?
Yeah, but you know what? 95% of the artists are in the lowest possible position, I'm afraid. We always read about all the art stars and all the artists that are attaining these giant sums of money. But no, I'm afraid that the artists are 90% of the artists in the world, or 95, are at the lowest strata of this flow chart. Because the art, I mean, Instagram is very empowering for artists today. Because when I first started, when you guys were in diapers, if you wanted to communicate, sorry to keep making fun of that, but I'm just like upset that I'm so old. But in the, when I started, if you wanted to convey an image, if you wanted to communicate an artwork from one human being to another, you would have to take a tiny photographic slide that was, no exaggeration, 1 inch square, and you would have to put 20 of them in a plastic sleeve, and send them to a gallery to try to get a foothold into the system, because there was no Instagram and there was no email and there was no JPEG. So literally you had to rely on regular mail. And not only, like, you'd have to rely, most galleries would not even entertain looking at unsolicited material by an artist. And when there was a recession in the world in 1990, from 1990 to like 1995 to 1997, there was maybe one or two galleries in all of New York City that would entertain opening that envelope and even looking, casting eyes on the material that you would send to them. So, I mean,
but
today
that's still the same. I mean, you can't cold call galleries now. That isn't something where artists can just. I mean, Go on.
No, of course, I agree with you completely. That's why I'm saying that generally, for the most part, the majority of artists occupy the lowest rung of this hierarchy, today. But, and there's a very important but, tools like social media, as much as people say that social media is a scourge of society and it's causing like pollution in the minds of children, and there's a new documentary about how people are addicted to their screens, you know, but during the pandemic, if it wasn't for screens, we'd all be visually illiterate for 4 months, which is a big chunk of time in the big scheme of things in our lives. So the point is that art, I have found, I'm sure you have too, I have found so many artists through surfing on Instagram. And there's one artist that comes to mind, and her name is Eva Berrison. And she just turned 65 years old. And because of the fact that her husband is infirm, she doesn't barely ever travel. She has a small gallery in Vienna, but her work was entirely unknown on an international level. And somehow we found each other. I can't even describe how. Neither of us can define exactly the point on Instagram we met, but we are certain that's where it happened. And since then, I've showcased her work in an art fair in Los Angeles that occurred simultaneously with Freeze, called Felix. And the work is sold to private museums. Sorry to, like, I'm a walking contradiction in terms, but if you can't contradict yourself, who are you going to? And the work has been widely dispersed. I just sold a piece this morning. I staged an exhibition on Instagram. I wrote an essay, which you could read on my website, which is just myname.art, and put some additional work on the website. And now the woman's been offered 4 gallery shows. So using nothing more than your telephone and what's at hand, you take a simple photograph of your work. The tools are now in the hands of artists that give them strength unprecedented in the history of art. I can unequivocally say that even though it's as difficult as ever, and the art world is a very, very tough place to break through and get a foothold into the system, which, and again, that reverts back to why I'm even in front of you people. It's because of my writing largely. And the fact is that I want to be, like, again, like when I came to stopping 2 days ago, what I'm doing because of this onslaught of threats that I received, I get the feedback I get from Instagram. And by the way, anyone who's listening can get in touch with me. I always say to every lecture, I lecture all over the world all the time when you're allowed to give lectures to a live audience. And I've done too many Zoom conferences and live Instagram talks, and anyone wants to hear anything more about me. But I will get any single person from any corner of the globe that contacts me. It's my duty, and I'm compelled to answer them, and I always do. And I mean, I've given lectures for kids at my kids' school, and I said the same exact thing to these 14 and 15-year-olds. And then one day my son said to me, like, what are you doing today? And I said, I have a meeting. And he said, who's your meeting with? I'm like, I don't know. It's one of the kids from your class. And he said, what the hell is wrong with you? Why are you meeting with one of the kids from my class? And I said, well, he wanted to. He asked me to talk and pick my brain, which doesn't take very long. But I literally return every single DM, every single inquiry to me. I've met literally hundreds of people face to face from Instagram, and I return everyone's query. And it's my responsibility and my duty. And with my writing, I feel like I would have stopped 100 times if it wasn't for the heartfelt feedback that comes to me at this stage of my career. Every day I get an email or a DM from someone, please don't stop. You're the only person that tells things and inspires people. Like, you can cut through all the bullshit and all this terrible behavior and find what's underneath it all, which is so alluring. Yeah. My passion has never abated for one second. I get chills talking to the both of you. I mean, that really
defines my existence. Well, let's talk about your passion, Kenny. Let's talk about your passion then. Yeah. Let's talk about you being a collector. You started collecting very early on, and you have amassed the biggest collection. And then last year you had a sale at Sotheby's where you sold a lot of your work, and you're collecting again with the money from that. Let's talk about how you got amassed a collection and what that was like then selling it all.
I would say 80% of what you just said is wrong.
Oh, okay. Go. Correct me.
We did have a little tiff about this on Instagram, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Russell?
Yeah, we
before
did.
Before you even knew. Sad, didn't he?
No, I believe the word he used, all he wrote, Assad, look, I love both of you now and I'm a loyal friend for life. But the first word you ever said to me was shameful. I believe.
What you said, right?
Correct
me
if I'm wrong. It's a shame. It's a shame for the artists, is what I said.
Yeah, but let me just, okay, so that really pisses me off. But I have a great deal of respect. We have a lot of mutual friends together, like Tracy Emin, who I think is one of the most brilliant, profound human beings I've ever had the pleasure of meeting in my entire life. And she inspires me every day. And because of that alone, I'll love you forever. But you really did piss me off to no
go on.
To
yeah, but
no
I,
end.
When Russell wrote no, that, wait. I actually contacted him because I thought he hadn't understood what was going on. I think he had basically misunderstood what the premise
right,
of
so
the
let me,
was.
Right, so let me just explain. Okay, so I lived in London for 15 years. I thought my house was going to sink into the foundation, and I had so much stuff. I thought that I was going to be one of these people you read about in the Daily Mail where they hoard so much crap that a pile of it falls over and suffocates them to death. And I honestly thought there was a chance that's the way I was going to lose my life from my collecting. I had car magazines and auction catalogs and art books and all kinds of detritus, as well as first edition books and art. I love art. And I always say the best collector collects with has no money is not an impediment to the best collector collecting. You'll find a way to beg, borrow, and steal. And a lot of people have actually stolen to buy art. The most famous one, which I use an example, is a surgeon in Boston who is the head of a children's heart surgery foundation. And he amassed one of the greatest collections of contemporary art in the 90s. And in fact, he stands as a symbol for someone who launched the whole kind of a sector of the art market, contemporary, into the money-making machine it is now, because he loved art so much, even when he had no money, he found a way to collect it. Unfortunately, he stole the money from a fund that was meant to help children have heart surgery. That didn't stop him from collecting. And when he went to jail, where he belonged, his collection, Christie's made a determination to stage the first time in history in 1996 that contemporary art was offered at an evening sale at Christie's. And it hadn't been done at Sotheby's, and it would have been a year later till Sotheby's jumped on board. But the point being that contemporary art was never a profit center for the auction houses. It was a market defined by modern and impressionist art, where the big bucks were. So when this surgeon, who was, like, I joke in the most cynical, terrible way, and say he was the best collector because he, you know, he had to steal money, but he still had to have it. So it's not terribly funny, but often I'm not. Anyway, at this auction was the first time that Jeff Koons was sold in an at auction, and he made a world record in 1996. And you know what it was? $260,000. Kiki Smith, an amazing American artist who must be in her 60s right now, she sold a piece for slightly above Jeff at $270,000. Robert Gober, who for me is probably one of the very greatest artists alive today, he was also in the auction. And Jeff Koons' record was $260,000, and 25 years later, it moved to $90 million. But that was the first time that contemporary art ended up on the radar of the auction houses as a place where they could make money. And here we are today, where oftentimes it's the only discourse that surrounds the art. Anyway, I've been collecting art for 30 years, okay? And I have the what I sold at this auction at Sotheby's called The Hoarder was 116 pieces in a collection. I don't, you know, I love art and I love to collect. I can't tell you, I honestly cannot tell you how much money I have made since my first and second year out of law school in 87, 88, or 88, 89, sorry. I don't, I'm such a bad business person. I'm such, I don't define myself by money. And if I did, I'd be, have a pretty low impression of myself. But I don't care about the deals. I don't care about the money. I get more satisfaction writing and teaching than I do from selling a Van Gogh or a Monet or a Cezanne, you know, all net of worth. Which I've done.
I read that you know your net worth by how much your art storage increases over time, how much you're paying every year for your art storage.
I mean, that's I can't, to this day, I can't tell you how much art I have. I can tell you that I have, as I'm sitting here talking to you, I have somewhere around 600 pieces to 1,000 pieces. So I sold 116 lots, Mr. Tovey, and that constituted about 1% of my collection. 1% in my house. I moved to New York, and already there's not, like, I'm a maximalist. So in my house in New York, you, if you wanted to hang a piece of art that was 30 centimeters square, you'd have to fight to find a place to put it. I am smothered in art. I'd rather look at art than out of a window at a sea. That's how sick I am.
What was the premise then? The premise was to sort of
I have too much shit.
Free
I mean,
the works
the,
that were just in cupboards, basically, or in storage, so that other people can enjoy them.
I have three children and a family, and I've been married for 25 years. I have to make a living, and I don't know anything else to do. I was the worst lawyer that ever lived. I'm the worst art dealer that ever dealt a piece of art. I loved fashion, but I couldn't – I'm not a salesman by nature. I love to read. I love to think. I love philosophy, and you can't make a living as a philosopher other than a teacher. My writing pays peanuts. My teaching pays peanuts. I just lost one of my teaching jobs because of the pandemic at School of Visual Arts. The admission is down by 50%, and they're probably going to end up in another year of Zoom classes. So art is my sustenance. So I have been in the art game for 30 years. My blood and my sweat is in art. When it took 4 months to dig out of the crap in my house. I call all of my art crap in the most loving, caring, kind way. But I just think, like, look, if you're not curing a disease, it's something extra. The same, I mean, for me, art is philosophy. It's a physical, aesthetic, illustrative manifestation of thought, of psychological, historical, sociological, economic, everything. Art is my life. I make a living selling art. I make art. I sell very little of my own art. I don't make art to sell it. I make it because I have to. And I think it's better to be in a position. I finally had a few pieces that really started to sell well in my career as an artist. And I could so easily see how you can get stuck into the position of repeating yourself. Because when one piece of art that you've made starts to sell, people want one thing, the same thing you just sold 5 minutes before, and you get stuck into this pattern of making 3,000 paintings that are indistinguishable amongst one another. Okay, so it took me 4 months to dig out of the stuff that I had in London, and I sold a tiny fraction of my stuff. And I did something which, again, I think like you miss. First of all, nothing I sold I had owned less than 4 or 5 years. One piece I owned for 30 years. Okay, that's number one. I believe it's immoral to buy something from a gallery under the pretense of wanting to keep it and then selling it at least within the first 3 or 4 years you've owned it. That's unethical practically. So I don't do that. That's not how I make a living. So, and then second most important thing was that I sold it with no reserve. So I never even calculated whether or not I probably lost money in that auction. Everything sold. It had a great response. It went super well.
I think that was what my comment came from, though. That's why I made that comment.
Bullshit. That's bullshit. I mean, sorry. But what I did was something so important. I gave everybody the chance to buy work. I gave everybody the chance, and I'm going to do it again. So get your nasty comments loaded up because I'm going to do it again.
It wasn't nasty. It wasn't. Do you know what? I didn't know the story behind it, but my thing was is that I said I felt it was a shame for a lot of the artists because there wasn't a reserve.
Why?
And my fear was that a lot of these artists' works would sell for like $200 or $1,000. And they're these artists that then it's that whole speculative market of the commercial art world.
Of course.
Where they undersell their primary prices, then they're fucked. And I think that was what it was.
Okay.
And then I think you got really upset me that I was making a personal attack on you, but it was to do with the artist.
It wasn't. What I did was actually pretty noble because, if I say so myself, I like I said, even to this day, I don't know if I lost or made money, but a lot of people got to buy art that they really loved that they could not afford. Also, one of my stupid little pieces, I'm being flippant. None of the artworks that I sold for whatever price is going to materially affect the market or the life of an artist. If you're selling 20 Boafos, a Malko Boafo who you had on your show,
One
of the brightest,
Russell Kleck as well, before he was well-known.
Okay, one of the most stunningly successful young artists. Okay, so I didn't sell any recently made art. There was one artist. Okay, but let me just say there was one artist out of 116 artists that complained to me, and I had bought his piece, and then I spoke to him, Oliver Osborne, who's a friend of mine. I did not buy his piece on the primary art market. He sold his piece. His gallery was negligent in selling the piece to one of the most notorious, shitty, hideous speculators known to the art world. They sold it to this person, which they are guilty for even selling a piece to this person. That person flipped it. It ended up in auction before like the gallery even got paid. That's how disgusting it was. Whoa. So another speculator bought it at auction. I bought it from them and I loved the piece so much, but the piece started to fall apart and it was only like a 4-year-old, 3-year-old piece. Oh. And I got the artist to remake it, but he remade it and gave me a different piece, not the piece that I initially fell for, and I sold that. And that was the only complaint, and I bought that. That piece has been sold 3 times before I bought it. So, like I said, I did not one iota of a thing that I regret or that was disrespectful to anybody. And people that love, so many people thank me for having the opportunity to buy art they loved that they ordinarily would never have the opportunity to afford, and I did nobody any damage. If anything, I probably lost money to end that discussion.
Yeah, but I also feel like you'd also just had a really bad experience with the whole Inigo Philbrick case where he was selling work that he didn't even own or whatever the story is. But I think, didn't you lose quite a lot of money from that? Because I also feel sometimes if people have lost money and they need to make money in order to...
That had nothing...
That wasn't related to it, right?
No, Inigo is important because it talks about a lot of other problems in the art world. He's endemic of the financial discourse that has stifled and suffocated the art world. This was a young guy that stole somewhere between $50 and $100 million from people. But really, the biggest victims of his fraud were 2 art lending companies. And it was really the perfect storm. And I think he's going to come to symbolize a kind of bookend of the last 25 years. So it started with this surgeon who stole money from children to fuel his art collection. And it ended with this 33-year-old guy. He only just turned 33. And he was partners with Jay Joplin. Until the day he was arrested by the FBI, he was still owning a lot of assets and in partnership with Jay Joplin, who's one of the great art dealers, again, who I have the utmost admiration and respect for, the owner of White Cube Gallery. But Indigo, what people don't understand, was a bright, capable, intelligent, personable person who just went off the rails because of mental illness, drugs, and alcohol addiction, and greed and hubris, just pure arrogance. But the fact was, it's the people, everyone wants to make a quick dollar. Everybody reads the headlines that a stupid painting by the studio of Leonardo da Vinci sold for $450 million and then ends up in the perfect place as like soft cultural capital in Saudi Arabia, where journalists get murdered for doing the kinds of things that I do. It draws people into art, thinking that art is a place with no regulation, the wild, wild west, a freewheeling place where anyone could turn a quick dollar in 5 minutes. And that is the furthest thing from the truth possible. Larry Gagosian, who has 300 employees and 18 galleries spread across the world, so much so that there's never a period when one of the galleries is closed during the regular course of business. But Larry Gagosian is not someone who just popped into the art world to make money. He's been in business for 30 years or more, and he's one of the smartest, most passionate, art-loving people that exist, and the world's most successful dealer for a reason. He had on payroll for 5 or 7 years John Richardson, who's the world's foremost Picasso scholar, paying him for $500,000 a year for like 10 years. And he only ever did like 3 shows. And they were shows a museum could never do.
Tracy took me to his apartment. Yeah, Tracy Emin took me to his apartment.
Coolest thing in the world.
And I met him.
Is that
the best thing ever?
What a passionate. I mean, again, I'm getting the hair standing up on my body right now, speaking about him. The thing is that museums, for whatever sad reason, don't have the resources and the flexibility and the nimbleness of a gallery like Gagosian afforded a private institution or commercial institution to stage exhibitions that could never have been done. And they supported John Richardson in the latter part of his life, which was, I mean, it enabled him to continue his scholarship. And it was extraordinary, the exhibitions he curated. Museums just didn't have the flexibility or the financial resources.
No, I mean, I saw the Picasso show in King's Cross, and it's one of the greatest shows I ever saw.
I thought the whole
installation of it, like all the walls they built, like all that kind of thing, like when they had those recessed kind of shelves and stuff, it was so beautifully done. And I agree, a museum wouldn't even have had the budget anymore, sadly, to have done a show like that.
It's just some of the stipulation from the Picasso family, just as a little side story, there was a contractual stipulation that once the gallery was painted for the exhibition, none of the crates could be opened for a period of between 3 and 4 weeks until the paint had a chance to utterly and completely dry, so there wouldn't be a chemical interaction between the paint and the artwork. No museum can afford to sit idle for a month like a gallery could, like a Gagosian. Anyway, what I'm saying is that Indigo is just an example of rife greed. And that's endemic to, that's part, I mean, the art world is like the only place that celebrates the 7 deadly sins. There'll always be crime. There's a bell's curve of morality and ethics in the world. And there's always going to be someone who breaches it, no matter how regulated the world is. And the great writer, Georgina Adam, for the FT and the Art newspaper, she stated in a seminar that people say that the art world is unregulated, but there's 165 laws, commercial statutes that are applicable to any given art transaction. So I think that Indigo is endemic of an art world that's gone money crazy, where these lenders loaned money to him without doing their due diligence, and they just chucked money at him, and he went off the rails for his own sad reasons. So
I remember him really early on, because he came to our gallery and we did a group show with Virginia Overton in it, and he bought I think one of the Virginia Overton sculptures from that show. And I remember him seeming like he was actually quite nice at that point. And then about a year later I saw him, and I remember just thinking, my God, he'd been so kind of corrupted by the power. You can like see it, you know, in the way someone behaves. And also the way they kind of distance themselves from you, even though they knew you a year before. Do you know what I mean? It's like very odd. Because if you're not part of that power structure, you're not useful to them. And I remember being very disappointed by him. I find it incredibly sad, that story.
If you stop right there, that's if I could define myself, it would just be in the sentiment of what you just expressed. I don't care where I am in my career, and I always think I'm the biggest loser in the world and the biggest failure, more or less. But like, I will spend any single person that ever reaches out to me for anything. Yeah. I feel it's my obligation to give back. I spend my whole life accumulating the knowledge that I have, however small it is, and you could fit. It takes about 3 minutes to pick my brain, but it's my responsibility and my duty. And the reason I won't stop writing, even if it's the death of me, is that I owe it. I mean, I love art so much. I want to give I call myself cynically idealistic, and really, art is it's the fabric that keeps my family together. It's a means. It's my duty. If anyone has a question, I want people to come away from my article or speaking to me or listening to me, however bored they may be. It's a good cure for insomnia. At the same time, I want to give people, like I said, I'm cynically idealistic. I hate everyone. I don't trust anyone until they give me reason to think otherwise. But I always give people the benefit of the doubt. And if they have any query or any curiosity about the art world, I want to be the person that inspires them about what the possibilities and the opportunities really are. Because I have not lost one iota of love and passion. It's as simple and as corny as that for what I do
started. By staying open like that, I think you learn. And that's obviously something that is important to you, to learn and grow. And that's also 100%. What you've just explained about Larry Gagosian, because, you know, by working with Richardson, you know, he's able to learn because, you know, it's knowledge. Yeah. And that is actually what we should all be holding up, is this idea of knowledge. And that's what talk art is. That's why we like people like Jerry Saltz. You know, that's why we like all these artists that you've championed over the years, like Canberra Fala, you know, Tracy Emin, Joe Bradley, Ava Bereson, all these artists, Catherine Bernhardt. Like, you were the one that had the McDonald's painting, you know, by her, when everyone told me that she was a rubbish painter. And I remember seeing that work and being like, I love this, because to me it just felt pure and genuine, and like she had something to say, but also it was about shape and form, and you know, the way that she was creating paintings was really fucking interesting. And I feel like you've always championed these kinds of artists, you know, and that's all that's important to me. And yes, all the other stuff, you analyzing the art world, it's a side of the art world I try and hide from, which is why I'm in Margate working for Carl Friedman and, you know, doing what we do, because we're our own little thing, like a family, and I don't have to interact with all the bullshit that's what I mean. I feel like, out of being true to ourselves, like Russell, you know, like what, you know, being friends with him and all that stuff, we've also created our own art world, which is now kind of safe for me to be able to exist in, because I'm too sensitive for all that stuff, like the whole Inigo bullshit.
People are shocked to find out that I'm a sensitive coward underneath it all.
Yeah, but it's not very difficult to find that out, is it? I mean, if you look at the art you've shown and championed, it's all incredibly sensitive, you know, expressive work. It's not like it's cynical, you know, it's not even that conceptual. A lot of it is very expressionist, I think. So, yeah. Anyway, cheers to you.
So you're still collecting. You're still collecting, Kenny.
100%. I will never stop. I'll have another sale at Sotheby's. I bought two of Eva Bereson's paintings again to add to my collection. They're very reasonable price. I mean, great art is not expensive. A lot of people don't understand that you could buy incredible art for $500, $200. Mm-hmm. I bought something. So I bought a Tracy Emin. I was lucky enough to be able to get a piece from her show of very small paintings that she made during the lockdown at White Cube.
I love that show. I think that's one of the best shows she's ever done.
I mean, again, this is an important fact. Like, art is not big, flashy. Yes. Art could, some of the biggest statements could be made in the smallest means. And so I bought a piece of hers. I bought another emerging artist from a young dealer called Kate Wong. The artist has a very long name, which I can't pronounce, but contact me and I'll give you a list of the things I got. And I'm always getting stuff. It's just,
what do you look for? What do you look for in an artist, and how often are you buying?
That's a great question. Because because I studied law, there's a famous case of pornography in the Supreme Court of the United States. And in the 50s, there was a prosecution of someone who created pornography. And the judge writing the decision said, you know, I can't describe pornography, but I know it when I see it. So I think for me, What turns me on about art, or what makes me decide to buy something, like for me, the ideal artist studio visit is a visit. I mean, this is going to sound terrible, but a visit without the artist present, because I do critiques in schools all the time. And a lot of times the artist will blah, blah. But the point is, art speaks for itself. And like when you judge a piece of art, all of the variables that go into like what constitutes a successful artist or a piece of art that's, you know, historical on some level, what defines the art are like, you judge it, you make a million different calculations in your head, if that's the right word, of you look at everything that's happened in art history, everything that's happening now, and how you think that art relates to the historical continuum of art over time. So I can't really, I mean, it's something that touches you. It has to be intuitive. You have to feel it in your heart. At the same time, it has to be like all of the organs in your body combine, and through your eyes, through your brain, and through your heart, you have an experience which is a visceral, indescribable experience that results in this very basic, like Hallmark card emotion, where you get excited, you get the blood circulates, coursing
like
through your circulatory
hit,
system.
Isn't it? It's a dopamine.
Exactly. Sort of. Not in the bad way of two idiots in a pissing match at auction where they're outbidding each other just because it's a machismo display of dopamine addiction. But you're right. It's a chemical reaction, but it's an intellectual. It's everything that you live for in life combined into one beautiful aesthetic manifestation, which is ultimately indescribable.
Have you ever looked into the psychology of collecting? Why we collect? I mean, I'm like, I'm an addict. Yeah. People are like, why? And I'm like, I don't know why, I just do. And whereas my brother is no interest.
Russ and I
at
have
all.
Been like it since we were kids as well. We've both had that bug.
That's
since
amazing.
We were young children. It's really
that's so funny because
what is it? What are we?
If I tell you what Freud said, you really think I'm nuts. But I actually read what Sigmund Freud wrote, that hoarding and collecting results from like bad toilet training when you're a child.
Really?
But like some kind of anal retentive disorder. Wow. But in a way, I mean, in the worst case, you're like filling, I mean, you could dismiss it and say you're filling an emotional hole in your life. I mean, I've seen people that shop so much and don't even open the boxes. I know someone that bought so much stuff from Amazon. I was expecting Jeff Bezos, or however you say his name, to show up at their door and congratulate them on being the biggest purchaser of crap from Amazon. But
Amazon's history.
Look, it does give you that kind of hit in the same way that, you know, something bad does. But it's such a positive thing because, like I said, it has curative effects on the psyche. I can't say that word right. But anyway, so I don't know. I love to collect because what I think is most important about collecting contemporary art, and for young artists, art is like history unfolding before our eyes in real time. And buying art is a way of participating. First of all, you're helping artists to survive. You're helping the art world to stay above ground. And number two is like, it's like a newspaper or politics or, you know, or just human in technology. Art is a kind of reflection of who we are at a given point in space and time, socially, economically, psychologically, politically. So some of the best art of the last 100 years will emanate from the past 6 months, I could say. Over the next,
we are going to see
the effects of Black Lives Matter and the pandemic. This is germinating in the minds of artists and already coming to fruition through various works of art. I love the pro, like Nicole Eisenman, an extraordinary artist in America, a painter who paints like social realism. This is art that is timely, talks about gender issues and sexuality issues and gay rights and all of these different issues that have come to the fore right now. And I think that, again, like if there was an artist who was president of the United States instead of that embarrassment, warmongering, hateful, spiteful, small-minded, hideous orange menace. If we had an artist, I mean, imagine what a better place the world would be today. I mean, you never see also female serial killers or like all of these lunatics killing each other. I mean, there were protesters in America that walked into a fast food restaurant with shoulder carried anti-aircraft missile weapons protesting about having to wear a mask, not only to protect themselves, but protect their fellow persons on the street, others. And like, I mean, what the fuck is wrong with the world we live in? It's so shocking. And art is the only thing that gives me solace besides my family and my friends.
Me too.
And that's it.
You know what? I was just thinking when you were talking about your experience, like with what art means, like art for me gives sort of meaning somehow to this crazy fucking world. And like, you know, we're both obsessed with Shawanda Corbett's work, who shows with Tommaso Corvimora. And I've just got a tiny little ceramic by her. Well, it's maybe not tiny, but it's like 50 centimeters or something. Because something in my like gut, when I see that ceramic, like I love it so much. And like you say, it wasn't that much money at all, but it's something that I feel incredibly compelled that I have to live with it. And I think that's the kind of collection that I love and admire, is when you feel that it is also a reflection of someone's own, you know, journey through this crazy fucking world. So,
I mean, that's why, just one thing. That's why I love prints and drawings. Drawings are so spectacular because it's the most intimate continuation of a thought to a piece of paper through the hand of the artist. And people don't understand, like, I mean, Julian Schnabel, I have a lot of respect for, but like an art piece doesn't exist unless it's the size of the side of a house for him. And I just think, like, for me, some of the most profound expressions of creativity come in the smallest form. Yeah. And, you know, size matters. Small is as powerful and as meaningful and as profound for me as big, and sometimes even much better, because it takes up less volume in a world that's flooded with things.
Yeah. Well, Russell and my whole friendship is based on drawings, because we bonded over Tracy's drawing titles. And it's been something that we've, like, it's followed our friendship, even to like Kembra Fala, like we now have tiny drawings by her. There's something about the intimacy of drawings.
Plus they're cheap as hell.
I love as well.
They're cheap and they're so...
Yeah, they're accessible.
You can buy a great... Yeah. Right. I mean, you could start a collection with $1,000. You can have 10 pieces.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's true.
And even more so, that's the other thing I love about Instagram right now, is the whole artist support pledge thing, where you can get a collage or a drawing for like £100. You know, it's really worth doing.
It is worth doing. It helps people on so many levels.
Exactly.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, talking about artworks of that you covet, if there was an artwork, this is one of our talk art questions you're now getting, Kenny Schachter. If there was any artwork in the world, you could do an imaginary art heist, a really nice theft of a work of art, what would it be and why?
I mean, again, like, you're asking the wrong person, because I would just throw a net out and take everything.
You'd also be way too noisy, I think, Kenny. I can't imagine you doing a silent art heist, like you rocking up to a museum. I think you'd set every alarm off and also talk to the security guards. Although maybe you'd win them round, actually.
I beg your pardon. Excuse me. Now you're starting with me. Don't you start with me now, because I'm happy to fight with you too.
I'll
see you on your
threat. It sounds like you're flirting right now, actually.
Why not? I'm an equal opportunity employer. I always told my kids, like, a hand is a hand. And if it's between your legs, it's going to feel good. And you should feel anything that turns you on is worth pursuing. Oh, my God. But anyway, I guess, like, I mean, Paul Tech, a meat sculpture, because it's just, I wanted to have my ashes secretly embedded in the middle of one of his sculptures, unsuspecting to only an X-ray. But I just think, for me, it just defines, you know, everything that I covet in life. It's about humanity. It's about the vulnerability of life and how we have to, we're all the same motherfucking people. And it's disgusting to think that the leader of like China, Russia, and America, I'm not so sure how Boris is doing in his job since I left a few years ago, but like, you know, it's so sad. And I'm really hurting within to know that the leader of a country should be uniting people. If you cut someone open, which is what Paul Tech's sculptures depicted, what we look like on the inside is, you couldn't distinguish anyone from any culture, from any walk of life, from any sexuality, from any race or creed or any background. An organ is an organ, and we're all the same people with the same desires, the same passions, or under an umbrella of human pursuits. And why do we live in the most divisive time in my entire life? I just don't know what to make of it. It's so irrational, and it goes against, I mean, you have Donald Trump saying that the people in Baltimore, where like John Waters is from, and a lot of great people throughout history, he's saying that it's a rat hole, a state within his own country. It's just so fucked up. Why are we in at this point, that the lowest common denominator has the highest exposure? and say in the
it
world.
Can't,
so
it can't last, can it? It's got there's got this.
It better not last
now. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, like, so pardoning I just think that, his friends yeah. as well. I mean, what the fuck is that all about? The commutation.
Yeah. So I just think, like, for me, Paul Thek exposes the humanity, the fragility of life and death is something that we all take for granted. Young people run around, like I said, and go to raves and stay out till 6 a.m, like my kids. And also, like, I mean, there's a lot of issues that just, you know, this type of art addresses, which is just like he made the most continuous thread throughout his career was painting on newspaper. Like,
yes.
He painted on newspaper because it's looked
seascapes
down upon as
stuff.
The. Yes, but he painted on newspaper because it was like a throwaway, cheap. On the art hierarchy, everyone values canvas and bronze among all other forms of art. But like we talked about, paper for us is paper for me is platinum. I love drawings and you do too. And that also ties us together. And so I think that these humble forms of art making and Paul Thek's humble use of materials, his work ethic was above all else what drove him. Just art is a way of life. It's not a thing. It's not a $50 million painting. Art is a way of life and conducting yourself and being open to people and ideas from people from all walks of life. And it's something that brings us all together, disparate people. Even Russell and I are now friends.
So we love us.
It brings together people
forwards,
with opposing. It brings together people that have, you know, you may think once you get to know someone, then you fall in love. And people don't give people the chance to even appreciate and understand each other from the most basic
especially,
level.
Especially you and me, Kenny. We fell in love very quickly.
Yeah, I was probably too drunk to remember.
Have you never got close to owning Paul Thek then? Or have you ever collected his work or had how much are these meat works if you were to... Oh, you do?
Well, I mean, right now, I had a load of them. I had to sell them for economic necessity when I was broke. I helped to curate a show at the Reina Sofia, the Whitney. I advised and I wrote a chapter in an MIT book. But I probably have, like, again, I don't, most recently, oh yeah, like one of the most recent pieces I bought was like a bronze, French Legion hat, which talked about Paul Thek embraced failure and weakness. He said there's strength in weakness. And I just love that. It just means like instead of like picking a fight with someone, like by being weak, but as ostensibly like a non-machismo competitive, I hate competitive sports. And that's why I get into art. And then art becomes more of a contact sport than rugby. But like, I love this kind of sentiment about like weakness and strength through what is from all outward appearances, what would be viewed societally as a weakness, but turning the other cheek and just embracing people for what they are and not being so judgy, even though I'm a very critical human being and I do it for a living. But I just like to point out the kind of hypocrisy that passes for the norm in the art world, which seems to be a little bit more extensive than in other sectors.
So we ask every guest another question. What is your favorite color?
Am I exhausting you, by the way?
No, not at all.
We could just keep going and going and going.
I feel like
you guys
sometimes
are so sweet.
Sometimes we edit the episodes, but I feel like with yours, we just need to let it be free.
Let it flow like diarrhea. I love blue.
Yes.
I love all shades of, yeah, but I love brown. I love the tan. I mean, it's funny. For 15 years, I lived in the UK, in London, and there's one thing I miss, just one thing. Besides people, and that's the Thames and the color of the Thames, the special kind. I made an art piece like creating a fictitious tube of paint called Thames Brown. And I remember when I first, I mean, on a sad note, it at times it could be very polluted and there's a lot of refuse that I would document through my day. I literally went to the Thames every single day of my time in London. And I love brown. For that very reason alone, and also because it's so frowned upon, there's actually like an order of colors that attain the highest amounts of money in art sales, and red is number one for some reason. And then I think white, and then blue comes third or fourth. The bottom of the heap is green and brown. But I love brown, but blue is probably for some stupid reason, unbeknownst to me, I love blue, especially in a nice old car from the 60s or 70s.
Yeah, because we didn't talk about the cars, but I always remember that about you. People were like, He's a collector.
I just love industrial design.
He has loads
I don't
of
like...
cars, and then he has exhibitions no. like next to the cars. And I remember going to Rose yeah. projects on.
I had a car under my desk in my office in London. But oh, I love Zaha Hadid, the architect, was my best friend. And it was I didn't know about art as an alienated, overweight, I actually stuttered. Part of the reason I never shut the fuck up when I talk is that for the first 12 years or 13 years of my life, even into law school, I couldn't publicly pronounce the letter D, and I stuttered. So I was overweight, alienated, had a my dad tried to get me to quit art altogether. And I came to cars. I don't like car racing. I don't like expensive cars. I like industrial design. And as a result, I had a very like incongruous relationship with Zaha, where we traveled to 10 different countries all over the world. And I revered her in the omnipotent power that she possessed because of her creative thinking and ideas. And so I love industrial. Cars were my gateway drug into art.
So what's next for Kenny then? What is on your radar? Who are you looking at? Who do you want to collect? And then when is this part two of your hoarder sale?
I was meant to have a show of my own art at Blum & Poe in Tokyo in March. And that's been, and it's funny because like I'm such the polarizing kind of human, and it's hard to imagine why I'm so nice and charming. Why would you ever want to sue me or beat me up? But that show is, people actually called Blum & Poe and said, how could you show such an asshole? How could you insert Kenny Schachter into your program when he's such a dilettante? I mean, a dilettante used to be historically something that was admirable, to be the jack of all trades. I mean, I do six different things that I could remember, and they're all under the rubric of art. So I wouldn't be able to write. I'm the only person probably that I know of that writes about the art world, but also curates, sells it, makes it, teaches it. That gives me the insight to be the writer I am, because I am not just talking from the sidelines, I'm participating. So the things that I'm most excited about are finally having this one-person show with Blum & Poe, where I get to express myself on a whole other level, and continuing to write and to find platforms to I mean, ArtNet is talking about going behind a paywall. And I said to them, if you even think for one instant that you're going to charge for my writing, I quit. I mean, the whole point of writing for next to no money is to be as accessible to as many people as humanly possible. If anyone is going to charge for my writing, it's going to be me, not ArtNet. I do enough for them already. And after this last lawsuit, I wrote an article I don't know how to say his name, but the painter that you've had on your show, Boafo. I've written a piece about... Amoako. I've written a piece about, you know, that this guy is 36 years old, I believe, and he's had 16 of his artworks come to auction, and they've all been in the 6 months of 2020, not even 6.5 months, the first 16 pieces that he has ever in his career publicly at auction have been in the last under 6.5 months, and they've all been, 15 of those 16 pieces were painted in 2018 and 19, and one in 2017, and that's criminal. But that's anyway. What I'm looking forward to do is
who's buying them works. Who's buying them works? And
you know, the crazy thing is, like, a bunch of fucking asshole speculators. One of which has just threatened to sue me. Should I say his name? Jeremy Larner. Okay, I said it. You could see why I need to be muzzled more. By even my family was like, "Dad, enough lawsuit threats. Maybe you should just sit it out for 6 months and have a cooling." They wanted to give me a timeout. My own children want to put me in the closet and shut me up because it's just enough for them. All the threats I get, literally, I mean, I'm not even exaggerating. I'll tell you next time we have a drink together, even though I don't drink, thankfully, for the world. Anyway, when Amoako befriended, unfortunately, some of the wrong people when he began to become more integrated into the contemporary art world, commercially speaking, and he sold work to what he thought were his friends for between, you know, $1,000 and $10,000. And I would say every single one of those 16 pieces that have come back on the market, not to mention all the private sales, which have probably constituted, I mean, I hate to say it, but I would say 60% of the pieces that artist has sold have been resold within the span of a year to a year and a half. It's tragic. And you know what? I think he's a strong artist, but a lot of artists have suffered at the hands of rampant speculation to the point where careers have been irrevocably damaged.
Because do you think his will? Because his prices have been kind of cemented now. They seem to be really
solid. There's another story. I mean, I'm sorry to just go on and on, but like, I just had a call today from someone asked me about the work of Matthew Wong.
Yep.
Matthew Wong was a very close personal friend of mine and his mom, and he just took his life in October. And I lost my son the same way a year and a half ago, who was only 21 years old. There's been an increase in suicides from the ages of like 15 to 25 alone, up 60% in the last 10 years. And it's a tragic manifestation of where of social media and a kind of mental illness, which is rampant and so unspoken about to this day. And society is really suffering because of all of these things and the hatred and the competition and everything that we're talking about is really affecting people in a way that is unprecedented in history. In my life, I'm 58 years old. I've never known a single person who attempted suicide yet went through with it. And anyway, Matthew's, the first piece of art of his to ever go to auction was a tiny drawing about 2 months ago that went for $60,000. And his first painting to ever sell at auction on a $50,000 estimate sold for $1.82 million. And there's something so morose and morbid about these people that dance on your grave. You know, it's just so disgusting, to be honest with you.
Russell and I had the same conversation a few days ago about that.
Like, who's buying that? Who's
it's so sad.
Well, you know, the people, the fact that there are people buying that art for $600,000 by Amawako, the worst thing is that it's going to shrink his market exponentially because all of the people that should collect his work, all of the people that rightfully should own his work, live with it and appreciate it and love it, they're now closed out of the market. And someone just called me this morning, literally this morning, before I started this conversation with you, somebody contacted me about Matthew's work and said, what do you think? I'm thinking about buying a piece today. So I'm like, what do you mean you're thinking about buying a piece today? The estate run by his mom, who's a beautiful, sensitive human being who's suffering the same way that my family is grieving. It's unspeakable, the loss that we're going through and experiencing. Mm-hmm. And she had such a hard time experiencing these auctions right now. And this person said to me, like, what do you think? And I said, well, you can't, what do you mean? You can't even, the family is closed down any further. The last posthumous show of Matthew, which he finished just prior to taking his life, transpired after his death. And nothing was for sale. And
the blue paintings at Karma Gallery.
Correct. So there's no primary market for Matthew because nothing is being sold by the estate. And I said to this person, like, how are you thinking of buying the work? Nothing's for sale. And he said to me, on the secondary market. And I said, you know, I love Matthew so much and his mom. Why on earth would you ever buy a piece now? Why would you? With the resources that the speculators are charging for the work, you can buy the work of 1,000 artists. Find someone else. Find someone even who's successful that doesn't need the support. You can buy a piece of art for $100,000 to $400,000 by a very successful mid-career artist, whether it's a work on paper or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, why would you even why would you want to dip into the market at $1 to $2 million? When, I mean, even this small piece that wasn't even the best quality of Matthew went for $1 million at Phillips, like a day after the Sotheby's sale. Mm-hmm. Why not buy something from someone who actually needs it? Who, not only that, but you could do so much better to find the support. I mean, you could discover an artist for nothing, for peanuts, not even like thinking about money, but just thinking about quality. Why would you want to spend that resources? Give away the fucking money to charity and
but
go
then
buy
I guess
a piece
Kenny,
of art
these
from
people. these people aren't thinking like us. I mean, and that's the whole thing. It's like different kind of human psychology, isn't it, as well, and power. Yeah. And
people buy
people
art
want
with
to have
ear.
Something this... they can't have as well, and all this weird shit. I mean, it's just... Yeah. And they're not art lovers.
Like, one quick thing. Sorry to cut you off, but you see how wound up I am now. But, like, when it's $1,000, nobody wants it. When it's $50,000, people start whispering. And when it's $500,000, everybody wants it. And that's human nature. It's pathetic, but that's human nature. More people are attracted. That's why people always talk about like me selling art or me collecting art or what. I mean, the artists that I love, like Vito Acconci, was a great conceptual seminal artist who changed the course of art history. And yet there's still no market for his work. You could buy a piece for $5,000 or whatever it is, even though Pace is now representing his estate. And people buy art with their ear, and they all, success unfortunately affirms success. And, you know, people that start to break out into that kind of exposure create a snowball effect of other people that want it simply for the reason that it attains such high numbers. And that's really, you don't buy art with your ear. I mean, I love the art dealer in Germany called Johann Koenig, and I just gave a lecture there 3 weeks ago in Berlin, and he introduced some prints that I made, which I was so proud of because I revere. I'm not art royalty. I'm art, like, peasant scumbag. But, like, you know, his father started the Munster Sculpture Project, was a curator at the Ludwig Museum for decades, and has been the curator of many biennales across the world. And Johann was he suffered an accident where he lost 80% of his sight. So I always say, I hate the saying that you have a good eye in the art world, because one good eye won't do it. You need two good eyes. Unfortunately, most people buy with their ear, according to what their friends recently purchased. But I just love the determination of an art. He wrote a book, The Blind Art Dealer, because he's legally blind. And that just did not get in the way or prevent him from becoming one of the greatest art galleries for emerging art in the world, based on his pure, crazy love of all things art. And I admire him so much for that fact, because it goes to show you, like, you don't even need a good eye. You can have no eyes. But if you could see 10% or put your hands on something, that's enough to have a passion and develop a love and an appreciation and an understanding about art.
Wow. Well, Kenny, we have a love, massive appreciation, and an understanding of art more so now from talking to you for the last 4 hours.
Thank you so much. This has been a talk art special.
Yes.
I think we understand each other a little. I think we understand each other a little better now, too. Yeah.
Do you forgive me, Kenny?
I love you, I could say.
I also think, I've just realized, Russ,
I think
you were thinking of Marc Jacobs' sale, where he said that he was going to sell it and then buy a whole new collection, like, you know, start collecting.
No, it wasn't that. No, it wasn't.
No, he was talking about me. But let me just, now that you just mentioned that, I have the greatest, I love grunge and I love Marc Jacobs. He's a genius, obviously. Yeah. But
talk into your phone, Kenny. Talk into your phone. Mouthpiece better. That's it. Go on.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Sorry. 1 second. Marc Jacobs had a sale, and he made all of these promotional videos for Sotheby's. I love the crazy ass shoes he was wearing. But he said that how he fell in love with all of these artists, how much he loves art and how the artists were his friends. And he turned around and sold every goddamn piece he ever bought from all of his quote unquote friends. I don't behave like that. And I think that's so wrong. I know his company started floundering financially, and he bought a major house designed by who designed the Guggenheim Museum, Frank Lloyd Wright.
Frank Lloyd Wright had to pay for that. Yeah.
Right, so he looked at his art collection as a financial asset, which so many people have done. I have respect for him, and everyone should do what the hell they want. We live in a free, relatively free world, although less free than it's ever been. But, I mean, to go on camera and say how much you love John Curran and his wife and Rachel Feinstein and all of these other artists like Karen Kalimnik, and then to dump every single piece at auction in the most high visible way, that makes what I look like Peter Pan. I mean, that's absurd. That's not
right. Do you think
the
artists were upset? Do you think they found that took that personal?
I mean, watching that video would make me cringe if I was an artist who befriended a famous. I mean, again, like, because he's Marc Jacobs and a celebrity, people would sell him anything. You know, the art world always acts to be on this high plane of greater human understanding. But whenever, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio strolls into an art fair or Brad Pitt, they get treated like, you know, Medici. It's fucking absurd. I mean, again, like, I'm selling the story that I wrote for New York Magazine about Inigo Philbrick and his capers that ended up in the UK Times about a month ago in the magazine section on a Saturday. And now there's a bunch of movie companies that are bidding for my story, one of which may be owned by our art collecting acting friend. But that guy has sold more art than I have. And you just wonder why. You have more financial resources than most people could. Let's just keep this between us and our 6 million listeners. No, this is, I don't care. Put it on the record. I don't care. Okay. It is what it is.
So who are we talking about? Leonardo DiCaprio?
I didn't say that.
No, he didn't say that. He mentioned two actors. I think he's actually talking about the other one.
Oh. Yes, that one sold a Rudolf Stengel piece to Inigo Philbrick through a proxy. So he bought a piece from Sadie Coles and sold it 6 months later. Why? It's beyond me. Why do people do that? Because it's a game to these people. They buy it and sell it because they can. It's trendy. You know, you hang out with all these, I don't know. Let's change the subject before I
think
get
it's also
started
to do with validation as well and like an ego and insecurity, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you're a celebrity like that, it's more to do with just glamour, being, you know, being in the game. It's a
feeling like you were wily or clever or whatever the word is.
Yeah, and it's not a game. It's people's lives
so
we're talking about.
Much. That should be the name of your film, The Game.
No, or The Guarantee. The Guarantee.
Guarantee. Oof, The Guarantee. That's a good one.
There you go. Anyway, thank we can have so, a whole part so two and much. Talk about all the auction bullshit.
Yeah,
so
well, when your movie
we'll
comes
leave
out.
Leave this to be. Okay, perfect.
I hope you get a starring role in the movie. They need you.
No, no. They'd have Danny DeVito playing me. What are you that's laughing at? You're not supposed to laugh. So
I love
it. Good casting. Yeah. No, great. Well, all images we've spoke about. It's going to be a busy Talk Art Instagram page is at Talk Art. Kenny, you're on Instagram and your handle is at Kenny Schachter.
Kenny Schachter. S-C-H-A-C-H-T-E-R.
We're going to link to you.
If you want to write anything to him, he will respond to everything. So bombard him. Keep him busy.
Please.
And that's I don't know good. How you and, do that, though, because we get so many messages, and I try to write to as many people as possible, but it's actually it's just exhausting after a while.
It's time-consuming, but
it's worth it. And then, anyway, so it's three of us. Three of us as kids who couldn't wipe our bums properly and have become collectors, in the words of Freud. And here we are finishing up this episode of Talk Art. But we will all see you again soon. Thank you
we'll
again,
be back
Kenny.
Very soon. Thanks for listening. Bye, Kenny. Bye.
Okay, bye. Thank you.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.